Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. We are fortunate to have on Talk Nation Radio this week Ann Jones, who is a journalist, a photographer, and the author of 8 books, including her latest, which is called They Were Soldiers: How the Wounded Return from America's Wars, The Untold Story. Ann Jones, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much.
So this is a very, very powerful book that I highly recommend to everyone. They Were Soldiers. You start out in the first chapter, if we can go there, looking at a part of the military called mortuary affairs. Can you tell listeners what that's about?
Yes. I think it's probably one of the grimmest departments of the military. It's the special units that deal with the dead. Their work is designed, I think, primarily to keep the dead out of sight of the soldiers still living and still having to get up the next day and carry on with the war. So this select group of very young people, of course, is charged with gathering up bodies that are often, of course, in multiple pieces, and many of those pieces cannot be found. They're charged with trying to match up the parts and pack them up for shipment back to their loved ones in the United States, and also with assembling all the personal effects of the dead soldier from the various places where it might be found, and going through that and putting that all together to send back to the family. All of this, of course, comes back through a mortuary, the National Military Mortuary in Dover, Delaware, where everything gets gone over again, and the dead soldier is finally prepared to be sent home to his or her loved ones. But you can imagine what a terrible job this is for the young, really young kids in the military who have to do this.
It's probably worth pointing out the obvious, since most Americans don't know it, that in fact, when we talk about the dead in a war like the war in Afghanistan, most of them are not the Americans. They are Afghans. But here we're talking about dealing with the dead bodies of the U.S. troops. Is that an accurate way to put it?
Yes, that is. And, you know, I think we do need to keep in mind all the time that the tremendous casualties in these wars have occurred among Afghans, among Iraqis, and enormous numbers, of course, of civilian casualties in both of these wars. But I think when we look at those death tolls and then we look at the relatively modest death toll of Americans, only about 6,500 dead Americans, and of course 100,000 injured. It seems like we're getting kind of a good deal here. And I think when you hear those statistics, you think, oh, aren't we wonderful? Isn't our medical system wonderful? And this, of course, is the line the Pentagon takes all the time. We give such great medical treatment to these soldiers. But to actually try to understand what those individual soldiers go through makes the story quite a different one, I think, because any American soldier suffers as much as anyone on the other side as well. And it's not a question of numbers. It's just a question of human suffering.
Indeed, and many are kept alive for lives of tremendous ongoing suffering whom medical technology couldn't have kept alive in years gone by. And so your book looks extensively at the wounded as well as the dead. I don't know if you know the numbers in these terms, but if you join the U.S. military, what are your chances of being wounded and as compared to your chances of being killed?
I don't know that. I don't know those numbers, and the numbers get more difficult to get in any accurate way without piling freedom of information applications and so on. So I don't know how to assess that. I'm not a statistician. I'm an observer, And so what I did for this book was actually pretty simple, but I guess other reporters hadn't done it. I just embedded with the medevac unit and traced, went with medevac flight from forward bases in Afghanistan to Bagram, the main Heath Hospital at Bagram base, the main air base in Afghanistan, and then with, again, the medevac flight to Landstuhl Medical Center, which is America's largest hospital outside the United States, and that's in Landstuhl, Germany, near Ramstein Air Base. And then from there, on another medevac flight, back to Dover, Delaware, where most of the wounded veterans are received and sent to Walter Reed. So I was just looking at what happened to soldiers who are wounded. And one of the things that I wasn't expecting, that I also paid quite a bit of attention to in this book, is what happens to the doctors and the nurses and the other medical personnel who treat them, because I found the medical staff really, extremely dedicated to doing their work, but very, very near to the breaking point in every case. Many of them just broke down and wept during our interviews because of the extent of the injuries they were seeing. All of these highly skilled medical professionals were seeing wounds and injuries such as they had never seen in civilian life or even in their previous experience as military doctors. And they were finding it extremely difficult to cope with.
There was one surgeon who described a difference to you between the injuries in Iraq and the injuries in Afghanistan to many U.S. troops along the lines of the difference between driving and walking and becoming injured.
Yes, he said the injuries in Afghanistan seemed much more severe because he said, although there were a lot of IEDs, those explosive devices, in Iraq as well, the soldiers were in partially armored or armored vehicles, and so most of their injuries, for those who survived the explosion, were, as he put it, still on their bodies. Whereas in Afghanistan, the soldiers were treated to General Petraeus's revival of so-called counterinsurgency, with the bright idea that the soldiers get out and walk around on foot instead of riding in their thousands of armored motor vehicles. So the wounds that they suffered were from stepping directly on bombs, and they were, in a great many cases, literally blown to pieces.
And those who are not, and who often lost legs and arms and genitals and every other possible part of their body, you describe them being operated on in these different bases in a series of operations in Afghanistan and then Germany and then the United States. How many surgeries does it take with these injuries?
Some of them have 70, 80 surgeries, but most of them will have 3 or 4 surgeries a day in the first days that they're hospitalized. These are the soldiers who are blown up, and they come in. They may already be missing large parts of their bodies, but then the immediate effort is of course, once they've succeeded in stopping the bleeding, the immediate effort is to clean those wounds and trim the tissues that have immediately started to die and get the soldiers in shape to go on to the next hospital. So they're doing these kind of cleaning up surgeries, which also often involve additional amputation to trim the legs and arms that have been shattered. And stop infection. They do that every few hours while a soldier is in their care until they can get the soldier sufficiently stabilized to move on to the next level of trauma care, that is to move on from Afghanistan to the hospital in Germany, and then again a whole series of operations in Germany and procedures to stabilize the soldier, preparing to move them on again to the United States. And once a soldier gets on that shuttle with all of these doctors working round the clock to save limbs and save lives, they have a pretty good chance of making it all the way home. But the doctors, and this was the horrifying part to me, the doctors were seeing such incredible wounds, you know, double, triple, quadruple amputees on a regular basis, that what they worried about was whether the soldiers, when they finally reached the U.S. and were brought back to consciousness and learned what had happened to them, were going to actually be glad to be alive. And, of course, the doctors at the U.S. hospitals were telling them, oh, yes, all these soldiers are glad to be alive. But the nurses were telling me quite a different story. And many soldiers who wake up having lost several of their limbs do not feel that way.
Ann Jones, your book, They Were Soldiers, reminded me in this regard of the book Johnny Got His Gun. And there's a scene you describe of a family, I don't know if it's at Walter Reed or one of the other facilities back in the United States, where the nurses bring a young man to see his parents and sisters and sort of swing him into their midst in a blanket and unwrap him, he having lost four limbs. How did you get to see such scenes, and can you describe what it was like?
Well, I had to be embedded with the military to do it. That is, I had to have permission from the military to do it, and I had to have an escort all the time. I generally wasn't allowed to talk to the soldiers in the hospitals in the States, because, as you may remember, there was a great scandal in 2005 when Washington Post reporters went into Walter Reed Hospital and found what terrible condition it was, and that many of the soldiers were just neglected and being uncared for. And since that scandal, they're very careful about letting people in to observe what's going on. But I was allowed to go in and watch and to talk to the medical personnel who served as my guide. And that was in the rehabilitation center at Walter Reed, the old Walter Reed, which has since been closed and gone into new facilities in Bethesda. But there, all the soldiers who had amputations were working in one way or another in this rehabilitation center. And to be in the midst of all these soldiers missing arms and legs and trying to regain, first of all, enough strength to go through the excruciating process that's necessary just to be able to learn to wear a prosthetic device. It was extremely difficult to watch, extremely.
Beyond those major injuries, many, many soldiers are, of course, coming back with injuries that are less visible, with brain injuries and with stress and guilt and trauma. Describe your account of the high rates of suicide and homicide and recklessness and drug overdoses that confront so many returning veterans.
Well, you know, once, let me say first that those, the damage that's caused by a traumatic brain injury, for example, or PTSD, they are called invisible injuries or invisible wounds because you don't see them right away. But in fact, the doctors usually don't see them for a long time because they so often occur in conjunction with physical wounds. And so the physical wounds are the ones that the doctors are taking care of first in those emergency settings. And normally the soldiers are unconscious, intubated, so nobody has a chance to check out what their mental situation is at the time, even though the protocols call for evaluating the mental state of a soldier who's been injured in any way within the first 24 or 36 hours of his injury or her injury. But of course, more often than not, that's impossible. So these soldiers, it may be weeks before they're back in the United States and their physical condition has been sufficiently attended to that doctors can really become concerned about what their mental state is. And by that time, as the neurological specialist told me, it's very hard to tell what is a structural injury to the brain, what is a psychological injury caused by through post-traumatic stress, and how much of that stress is caused by just by waking up in a hospital and finding out you don't have your legs anymore. So the evaluation of those mental wounds is really just a guessing game at that point. So we read statistics about traumatic brain injuries and PTSD, but in fact, nobody knows exactly what's going on with those injuries. Now, that said, when soldiers come back, a great many of them get into a great deal of trouble very fast, and that takes the form that we've seen in past wars of alcoholism, drug addiction, risky behavior, you know, driving fast. You hear of a lot of soldiers lose their lives in single car crashes. And then, of course, suicide. And very often, all of these things get mixed up together. And because it's so hard to separate out what's really going on and give treatment, a lot of these soldiers don't get adequate treatment if they try to get it from the military or the VA. And others who get it are inappropriately treated. And particularly now, the big problem is these opioid painkillers that, thanks to Big Pharma and its lobbying efforts with the military and with Congress, have succeeded in forcing upon the VA the adoption of protocols that call for prescribing opioid pain, just about any kind of pain a soldier might ever experience. And these were sold to the VA as perfectly safe, no side effects, and of course they turn out to be highly addictive, particularly in the young, which is a description of our soldiers. And they seem to be implicated in suicides. So some committees within the government have been looking into this for more than a year. There's now some talk of restricting their use, but by the time they get around to doing this, you know, thousands of soldiers will have died from overdosing on the painkillers that have been prescribed to them in the military itself. While during these wars, about a third of the soldiers at least were drugged up. And then when they come home, they get them from the VA. So it's not a pretty picture what happens to them.
It seems that maybe part of the problem with the treatment comes from the diagnosis, in that you've written about the military looking to just about anything other than participation in war as the cause of troubles in military veterans. Can they blame it on their family lives? Can they blame it on something other than having participated in war? Is there really a harmful reluctance to see that most obvious possible cause of trouble in the lives of these veterans?
Yes, it's ridiculous that it's this 1,000-pound gorilla in the middle of the room that nobody will look at. And the military, throughout these wars, has done study after study to try to find out why so many soldiers came home with PTSD or got in trouble after they got home. And, of course, the first person they want to blame is their wife or the girlfriend who sent them a Dear John letter by email, or who turned out to be unfaithful. So first they try to blame it on that. Then they try to blame it on financial matters. The soldier was not very good at managing money. And then there were a number of studies. This has happened in previous wars as well. The idea that if you study the soldier's early life, you can figure out which ones will be able to go through war without suffering after effects. So sometimes they try to apply those studies before soldiers go into the war, as they did in World War II. Now they try to apply them after the fact to find out why so many soldiers come home and murder their wives, or murder perfect strangers, or murder other soldiers when they get back stateside. And that, of course, takes us back to Freudian psychology. You know, what was it in this soldier's childhood that caused this problem? And pay no attention to the fact that these soldiers have just been through horrendous experiences in war. And one thing we do know is that a person may be altered. A person's character and personality may be profoundly altered in adulthood by traumatic experiences, no matter what kind of childhood they have. So all of these tactics are evading the obvious, that it is the war that has this terrible effect on the soldiers who go through it.
That would seem to be one of many important lessons in this book. What is it your hope that people take away from reading this book? For what purpose do you send it out into the world?
Because we shouldn't have war anymore. You know, I live in Europe now, and America looks so strange from this side of the pond, where people, the first thing on their mind is not war. People are involved with domestic issues. People are involved with improving their healthcare systems or education, or revising their immigration policies to meet the new demands. They're concerned about the lives at peace, the social lives within their own societies and within the European Union as a whole. Whereas in the United States, everything seems to be centered upon talking about the war. And we are the last nation on earth, the last developed nation on earth that makes war in this way. And we're so far out of step with the modern world, so far behind the times, and yet the United States still entertains this delusion that our fantastic military power makes us a wonder to the world and deeply admired by the rest of the world. In fact, in my experience in living and working in the rest of the world, from here, America looks now like the most dangerous country in the world and the most aggressive. We have this notion of projecting our power and our force around the world so that we have soldiers stationed in something like 177 different countries around the world instead of staying home. So no one does this anymore, and no one looks upon the United States as a great power for doing this, because clearly we go into these wars, we make a total mess of everything, and we haven't won a war in, well, that's a toss-up, but it's a good long time ago. And we have saddled the rest of the world, particularly Europe, with huge problems now of refugees escaping from the countries that have chiefly been affected by American intervention in their domestic affairs. So I would like Americans to take another look at what our country does and to stop it. There's no need to be making these wars. Why are we doing it? Who can remember the purpose of the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan, neither of which was necessary, both of which are illegal by international standards, both of which have nearly bankrupted our own country, caused irreparable suffering to our own military, badly misused by civilian leaders and mediocre generals as well, and terrible damage to our own society as we try to pay for our wars by cutting into what few social programs we have for the poor, including those very same soldiers, those veterans who've returned home. So I wrote this book to say, look at what we're doing. And if Americans cannot be impressed, as they seem not to be, by the damage we do to the rest of the world, I thought perhaps it might make some impression on Americans if they could see the damage we do to our own individual American kids by putting them through this.
And it is extremely well done, and I highly recommend that everyone pick up a copy of They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Return from America's Wars, The Untold Story by Ann Jones. And in particular, give it to anybody who might be considering joining the military. Ann Jones, thank you very, very much for being on Talk Nation Radio.
David, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.